Wayfair's Black Friday and July sale is almost here. Starting July 24th, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair, plus amazing doorbuster deals and free shipping site-wide. Shop the sale at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Welcome to What's Eric Eating, Culture Map's bi-weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map editor Eric Sandler. Today on the show, I'll have a conversation with someone in the food world I think you'll want to hear from. She is the chef behind Burmalicious. She is a James Beard Award semifinalist. She is a MasterChef finalist. She has way more followers on Instagram than I ever will. Sue Kinn, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, Ari. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for doing this. I'm delighted to have you. You know, I've been, I think like many people in Houston, I've been following your career since you were on MasterChef. You made it all the way to the finals. It's a very difficult cooking competition show, so you deserve a lot of credit for that. Tell me a little bit about how you got started cooking, because, you know, I don't think many people know a lot about Burmese food, which is what you make, and kind of how it's different than other regional cuisines in Southeast Asia.
Right. You're absolutely right. Like, I think many people haven't heard of Burma in general, so let alone have tried Burmese food or even know where it is on the map. So food has been a big part of my life since as far as I can remember. I've technically grew up in my grandmother's kitchen and her garden. So I was actually born and raised in Burma. Like majority of my life, I would say 75% of my life was spent in Burma. So technically, like, you know, in the morning, I would go out into the garden, to my grandmother's garden, and start collecting fresh herbs and fresh vegetables. Come back to the kitchen and start chopping, peeling, pounding everything in a mortar pestle. We're talking about, you know, a six-year-old Sue. I told everybody that if you think cutting onions makes you cry, like, imagine pounding lemongrass, ginger, garlic, onions, chilies, everything in a mortar and pestle. It was a lot of hard crying growing up. And also, I always have somewhat of cooking was always seen more of a chore because of many social norms attached to it. You know, I grew up in Burma and it is mostly under oppressive military dictatorship. So when things are already hard enough, you know, we always are dealing with, there's a lot of uncertainties and also lots of fear. But I grew up particularly in a very conservative home where, you know, cooking was mostly seen as a requirement. It was a social expectation towards girls to grow up properly, to be a woman who pretty much serve men properly.
Right. So right. A wife and mom, right? The head of the house.
Yes, absolutely. And, yeah.
And just to clarify for people, you call it Burma, but on a map it's Myanmar.
Yes. So yes, like, to confuse everybody even more, so we have two names. So I always say Burma is not as inclusive as Myanmar. So Myanmar is more of an inclusive term, being that we're made up of 135 ethnic groups, and Burmese people are only, it's a majority, but still it's only a certain portion of the country. But we always go back to the name Burma because the name change from Burma and Myanmar happened during one of the military coup. And to show our disobedience to the military government, we keep on calling it Burma. So yeah, it's very contextual. Sometimes if we want it to be more inclusive, we call it Myanmar. Sometimes if we want to be like, yeah, we are against the military government, we call it Burma.
Well, and also since you're of Burmese like cultural heritage, it makes sense that you would choose to use that word rather than
absolutely.
Myanmarese, I'm not even sure if that's a...
No, there's no adjective for Myanmar. Yeah. Myanmar, yeah, it's just Myanmar in general.
All right. So how did you make your way to the United States?
So, yeah. So it's always been like, it's both for me, for myself and my brother that, you know, we always want to escape that. We always want to escape that oppression. We always want to see the world, you know, taste the freedom, especially for me as a girl with all these social norms that I grew up with. So I first moved to United States when I was 23, and that was to go to a grad school in Massachusetts. So I went to University of Massachusetts for an MBA program. So, you know, the cooking that I always seen as a chore or responsibility. I always say that I'm going to stop cooking once I leave home. I immediately pick up cooking as soon as I moved out of the country and I came to America because Massachusetts, you know, I would say 7 or 8 months of the year it's snowing. You're always cooped up inside the dorms and the school. So whenever there's homesickness, whenever homesickness bubbles up, like I pick on cooking. So cooking become more like an extension of home. It become an ultimate tonic. And you know, in a college, when you know how to cook, you're pretty popular. So it's a great way to make new friends, to make new connections, and that's also how I met my husband Charles through one of the potluck parties. So yeah, so I spent 3 years in the United States, 2 years of school and 1 year of work, and I moved back. I moved back in 2015 with an MBA because the country was finally opening up, and you know, for someone with an American MBA degree, there was a lot of opportunities. So my goal was to just go back, take over the family business. There was a lot of foreign investments coming in, pretty much grow my family business, take over from my parents. But in the meantime, as soon as I moved back to Burma, instead of moving back in with my parents, I moved in with my grandmother, who was already around 95 years old. So I also took on the role of her caretaker, and then like I started cooking more than her. Like she would just guide me through the recipes. So every morning at the breakfast table, everybody call her mummy. So I will ask her, mummy, what do you want to eat today? You know, what are you craving for today? And she will never give me a straightforward answer. It will always be something like, you know, it's monsoon. It's been raining for a couple of weeks now. So I'm sure you're going to find like fresh young bamboo shoots in the market. So when you are getting those fresh bamboo shoots, like, you know, she will teach me how to pick the young, fresh ones. And also she will always be like, hey, you know, these bamboos are actually coming from the forest. So they're not been processed, so they will have a lot of toxins. So make sure, as you know, while you are getting bamboo shoots, also look for ingredients like bitter melon, so that these ingredients can counteract these toxins from the bamboo shoots. And she will also tell me the stories of her and her siblings when they were young, like going into the forest, collecting the bamboo shoots themselves, their encounters with snakes and lizards. So it hit me really hard one day that, you know, food is just a lot more than whatever you served on a plate. There's a lot of memories, histories, narratives that are cooked into each recipes and that are intrinsic to each family.
Yeah, there's
So,
a lot of like generational knowledge that's kind of being passed
absolutely,
down with
absolutely.
every recipe and every tip.
Yes, no, and you're also thinking of like languages and, you know, medicinal benefits, food pairing. So there's a lot more than just recipes. So one day it really hit me hard that she's already 95. She's only going to live for so long. She's still very, you know, active, very healthy, but she's only going to live for so long. And I'm only going to remember all of these recipes and stories for so long. So I started putting everything into writing, and that is when I started my food blog, Burmalicious. So it was an Instagram account and also a website. So I started taking photos of all the things that I cooked for her, and then started writing down the recipes. And fast forward 4 years later, I got married, and my husband Charles he's originally from San Antonio. He's been working in Houston for a few years by then. So I moved back to Houston in 2018, and Charles did an incredible job hyping Houston up, being that, you know, it's one of the best food cities, one of the richest, most diverse food cities, which he is absolutely right. And from time to time, I always thank him for, you know, letting me call Houston home. But to my disappointment, I found out that even in a global food mecca like Houston, there was no Burmese food. So it became my mission that, you know, I really have to put Burmese food on the map, close that gap.
So, obviously Burma is located next to Thailand. It shares a
Yes.
border with China. Can
Yes.
you just explain in a succinct way, like how Burmese food is different than like either Thai food or Chinese food?
Yes. So again, yes, we're sandwiched right between those three culinary powerhouses. So we have India, China, and Thailand surrounding us. We have a long history of British colonialism. So during the British rule, there was an influx of Chinese and Indian immigrants. So we definitely have a lot more influences from China and India in particular. The main difference from Thai food to Burmese food to be is that, I mean, we're pretty similar in the sense that our flavors are very complex and we specialize in, balancing like 100 different types of flavors in just one plate. Like we master the art of balancing flavors, both Thais and Burmese. The main difference would be that Burmese food is a lot less assertive, a lot less sweet, floral, and also a lot less spicy. I would say we have a lot of Chinese influenced dishes. Like we have a lot of noodle dishes, but Thai food will have more stir fries, whereas Burmese food is more like oil-based curries, like these long braising processes. And also, I would say like one of the very unique characteristics of Burmese cuisine would be that we use a lot more fermented products. So we pickle our tea leaves. Like tea leaf salad is one of our most unique offerings to the world. We use a lot of preserved fish, preserved shrimps, like fermented shrimps, shrimp paste, as such. Like for example, like if we're looking for something as a sour, tangy component, Thais would opt for fresh lime juice, whereas we will opt for either tamarind or preserved mangoes and preserved lemons.
All right, so you come back to America, you start a food
Yes.
blog about Burmese food because Houston doesn't have Burmese food. How did you make your way to MasterChef?
So that transition happened. The food blog that was merely to preserve my grandmother's recipes and stories, that transitioned to a food blog that demystifies and promote Burmese cuisine in Houston. It's like how I would make, I mean, what I would bring to a Super Bowl party or what a Burmese home cook would make for a Thanksgiving tables, like recipes like that. So the blog did its work. It caught many people's attention and also the attention of MasterChef casting department. And we're talking about only a year after I moved to Houston. So I randomly got a DM one day. I would say I think it's in the mid of like around like summer of 2019. I got a DM from a casting department saying that, hey, we found your blog from hashtag home cook. We're going to have an open call auditions in Houston sometime in October. Like if you're interested, if you want to, be a master chef, like come and audition. So I replied them that I would absolutely love to because I've always been a big fan of the franchise. Here's the funny thing. I think I'll get to continue the story in a little bit, but I'm always a big fan of the whole franchise, but I religiously watch MasterChef UK and MasterChef Australia. Yes, as an entertainment, and I would say 50% entertainment and 50% to learn English, to learn like culinary vocabs and terms and as such. So I told them that I'm a big fan, it's always been a dream, and I definitely would come and try out. But here's one thing. To be on MasterChef, you don't need much. There's only three qualifications. First is that you must be 18. Second is that you must not have a professional experience working in a professional kitchen. And the third is that you must be either US residence or US citizen. And being that I've only been in America for less than a year, I didn't have a green card. It was still in the process of application, and I think we're still waiting for the final interview. So I was like, I am still not qualified to come and compete, but if things miraculously happen in the next couple months, if I get the green card, I will definitely come and compete. And miraculously, I got the final interview, and the green card came in literally a week before the open call audition in Houston in 2019.
Wow. So you right on time. Just in time.
Yes, I always like joke around that I'm not Christian, so I don't want to say it's God's will, but someone definitely ordained that to happen.
The universe was looking out for you. You had good karma.
Absolutely.
All right, so talk about your time on the show a little bit, because it is a very intense competition. They sort of, they don't want you to have restaurant experience, but they sort of put you in
Yes.
situations that would challenge even professionally trained chefs. So,
Absolutely.
what were maybe one or two of the challenges you remember most, and kind of how did you, what was your experience like filming the show, with Gordon Ramsay and Joe
Yes.
Bastianich and the whole team?
Right. Like the nature of the competition itself is very challenging, and you're also adding, these dramatic effects, mostly fueled by Gordon Ramsay. But I would say the most challenging part of our season was that we filmed right in the middle of COVID. So that changed the whole format, not just for us, for the producers, for everybody. The open call audition happened in 2019 October, and there were still, so many steps. Like there was testing of cooking skills, cooking knowledge, and they require you to send you like millions of videos of you with your family, you with your friends, you in your natural habitat, like also showing off your cooking skills. We also have to take like psychology tests, personality tests. So it took about 4 months until we were flown out to LA. So the day that we were flown out to LA, I would say it was in the first week of 2020, February. So COVID was already starting. It has not, I don't think it has been in the United States yet. So we went to LAX. I think there was about 50 of us, and we went through like few more stages of competition, screening, and I would say about a week after they finalized us into just 36 people. And these 36 are going to compete on a film's audition in front of Gordon Ramsay, Joe Bastianich, and Aaron Sanchez. And then also there was a lot of other guest judges our season. And they will give out the final aprons, the final white aprons. So that was the thing. So the thing
Right. I
about
mean,
National Treasure.
that's crazy to me, right? They run you through this whole battery of auditions, and then you don't actually, like, you may only get 2 minutes in front of the judges with one dish up or down.
Right. No, yeah. There are so many people. Like, I think out of 36, I think only 25 made it onto TV. Like, yeah. And then, yeah, the other 9 or 10 people, we didn't even see, like, yeah, a glimpse of them. I think it's not just MasterChef, like, Top Chef and many other shows. I think, like, as soon as you land, like for us, as soon as we land in LAX, they took away our electronics, they took away our phones, they pretty much cut off our ties with the outside world, right? We can only talk to our family and friends maybe 30 minutes a week, and it's always like in front of a producer. So you definitely they don't want you to they don't yeah they don't want us to spoil anything. They don't want us to spill any tea, which is understandable. So we have no idea what is going on with the outside world. And I remember, so I've already made it to the final 36. We're ready to go into the film's audition. They took me and Charles to LAX to take some B-rolls. And on the way there, one of the producers would.
Right. They had to pretend that you were just getting into town, even though
Oh
you'd
my
already
gosh.
been there for
Yes.
2 weeks.
If you watch our show, the very first opening scene was me and Charles rolling out of LA. We were walking out of LAX, and I said, it was such a long flight. I cannot wait to cook for Gordon Ramsay. And I was wearing like a blue, flowy, beachy dress with pearl earrings on. I'm like, this is not my choice of clothing for a 36-hour flight. And definitely not what I would be saying like as soon as I land in LAX if I'm coming straight from Burma. So there's a lot of like storylines too, like that they were putting around us that we weren't aware of. Anyway, so while we're filming LAX, one of the producers told us that Amazing Race was canceled, and that was the very first Hollywood production that was shut down because of COVID. And I didn't think much of it. Nobody think much of it. We went through 3 days of films audition. And again, like, usually it was 36 to either 20 or 18 contestants, but for us, it was only 15 contestants. So that was the very first time. We are the smallest group in the history of MasterChef. So we're like, okay, something is, definitely different. And then after 3 days of those film audition, the families and friends cheering for us, and 15 of us got these white aprons. All our families and friends left, and we went into this intense filming, which again, like we never knew, how it was regularly done before in the previous seasons. In a sense that, now that we know that, we got to find out that the filming was actually done based on Gordon's schedule. So sometimes that, they would film 3 episodes a week, and if he has to go back to UK, like the whole production come to hiatus for 2 weeks, something like that. But while we were filming, they were filming every single day, like one episode a day, 2 challenges a day for 6 days straight, which they have never done before. And we didn't know. We weren't aware of how it was usually done. So we were like, oh, maybe this was how it's supposed to be. They want to tire us out. They want us to feel more pressure. But then at the end of the week, we're already complaining that, hey, filming days are long, right? Like call time is at 4 a.m. And I think it's the same everywhere. You're just hurrying up to wait. And then you don't come back home until 10 or 11 p.m. So we, again, without having phones, without having time to turn on the TV, we were completely unaware of what is happening in the outside world. We filmed nonstop during that first week for 6 days. We have something called a dark day where, because of the unions, like they can work at least one day a week. We went to
Right,
Target.
right. The cast isn't unionized, but the cameramen and all the crew, the sound
Absolutely. Yeah,
guys,
the
they
makeup.
definitely are, and there are strict rules about their time.
Right. For us, like, I don't think they care. They would juice us out as much as they could. But anyway, so we did a Target run on the 7th day after we filmed nonstop 6 days, 4 a.m. to 11 p.m. days. We saw lines in the Target that we went. We saw people wearing visors, and we were like, what is happening? And they said, COVID is finally here in the States. Everything is getting shut down. There's a shortage of everything. NBA has been canceled. And yes, we were unaware that COVID was actually going on.
Yeah, so essentially they were trying to rush you. They were trying to film as much as possible before they had to shut the production down.
Absolutely. Yes, which we were totally unaware of. And on the way back from Target, I think I talked to Charles, and then Charles was like, I've been calling you for the whole week because everybody's been worried, like how you are. And they were only able to talk to the producers. I mean, we are in a secluded space. We are in our own bubble, so we're technically safe. But of course, the families and friends are very worried about our well-being. And after the call, they said, hey, curfew is at 5 p.m. You all go into your rooms and then, get some rest, because tomorrow, for the very first time in MasterChef history, we are going to film 2 episodes back to back. So we're like, okay, let's do this. So, so we went and filmed 2 episodes. I mean, they managed it. We were fine. But then at the end of the night, it was already around 9:30. We have all the executive producers walking into our waiting room to break the news that we cannot continue any longer, and we have to send all of you back. And they were hopeful that the show will get picked up, but they were also uncertain that this might be the end of it.
How long were you out, and then how long did you like,
It was
because obviously
7 month hiatus.
you did wind up, oh, 7 months.
Yes,
Okay.
it was 5 months. So we came home in March, and it didn't resume until November.
Do you feel like that gave you an advantage because you knew some of what they were going to do, and you could kind of, were you able to practice things or prepare for things, like kind of knowing what they wanted from
Yes,
you?
it works in, I would say it's a double-edged sword, in a sense that when I first went in, I had no expectations. If I end up top 15, I'm happy. If I end up top 14, I'm happy. But when we go back, we came back as top 8, and everybody was like, nobody wants to be eliminated as top 8, right? Like after 7 month hiatus, like definitely you want to make sure you ended up top 5, top 3. So I definitely like, I think I know very little about French cuisine, Italian cuisine, like when I first went in the early 2020s. So definitely during that 7 months, I definitely honed my skills. I definitely get to, practice, learn, and cook more, like cuisines that I wasn't aware of. Oh, I wasn't familiar with. So, but then again, like it also gives people a chance to, how would I say, like see what your competition is. So before, we have no phones and no nothing, so we don't know. It's all whatever they say, right? If they say, "Hey, I'm a baker, I'm really good at baking," it's whatever they said. But then when now you have an access to their Instagram, and then you go and see, and they're like, "Okay, you're a shitty baker. You are not as good as you said you are." Some things like that. Like that was, I don't think, what they wanted us to know.
Did you reach out at all to Christine Hawk? Obviously, she's our resident
Yes.
MasterChef champion.
She is the face of MasterChef. I did not actually, but then when the show aired, I think before the finale end, she posted an Instagram story saying that there's finally another Southeast Asian finalist in MasterChef, and then she's also from Houston, so I'm ready to cheer for her, and that definitely was one of the best moments of my life. But yeah. And then after that, yeah, we got connected.
So obviously you come off the show, whatever success, like what, however well the food blog had been doing. I mean, obviously it takes off from the exposure on the show. When did you kind of decide that you were going to make that transition from documenting these recipes and sharing them on the internet to actually like serving them for people?
So, coming off the MasterChef, it was I would definitely say the biggest growth would be my Instagram following. So before the show aired, I had 3,500 followers, and it like exponentially grown to 35,000 overnight. And at the end of the season, 3 months later, I was at 100,000 followers. So I went on to this 35 city MasterChef live tour. So you're pretty much, recreating the whole show on the stage, pretty much trying to do these, like mystery box challenge. Like just pretty much recreating the whole show on the stage. So it was my chance to travel America while getting paid for it. So after that, I came back end of 2021, and people will assume that, I'm on high. I feel like I'm on top of the world. The world is my oyster. But actually, I was at my lowest because I was completely lost and I didn't know what to do. As in, I was like, should I just take leverage on whatever following I have now and just do product endorsement, become a content creator, influencer, or do I want to go into culinary school, probably, educated, get probably trained in a professional kitchen, or like continue doing photography, continue doing food blogger.
Right,
So,
because just to clarify, I mean, because when you started the food blog before you went on the show, you were
yes.
an MBA working in the business world. You were not
No.
making a living from the blog.
No. I mean, I was
And
doing like some food photography, food styling. That was pretty much the only food related stuff that I was doing.
right, but now you have this huge following, and it's like, well, you
Yes.
might as well harness it and try to do
Absolutely.
something, leverage it into.
Absolutely. Yes.
Right, okay.
So I started doing like some like private chefing. So like, there were like private caterings that I do. I go in and cook for like 30 people, this and that. I would say the biggest struggle will be internally, just dealing with imposter syndrome, because again, I have no professional training. I've never worked in a professional kitchen. So whenever people address me as chef, I feel so ashamed. So now I have to talk about this major turning point in my life that pretty much ignited my chef career. And Eric, you were a big part of it. I don't know if you know of this or not, but I want to talk about it. It was 2022 February, and that was my very first time, and I think that was your last time at Gold Buckle Foodie Awards. That was the very first time we met.
Yes. You were there with Joseph, who also
Yes.
competed on
Yes.
MasterChef. And
Absolutely.
I don't talk about it on the show very much, but I've seen every episode of MasterChef. I don't watch all the food TV shows, but I like Gordon's shows and I love
Yes,
MasterChef.
yes, yes. So, I think it was maybe early March or end of February of 2022, and I think James Beard semifinalist list had came out like maybe like 2 weeks before. I think Christine was on the semifinalist list. Chef Hugo was also on the list. Anyways, I was already feeling somewhat good, somewhat feeling inspired during those couple weeks. And on the way to rodeo, Joseph was driving, and then I was like, hey, do you know, like, who we are going to be seated with? Are we going to be seated together with influencers, or, are we going to be with the media because we were on Fox and such? And then as soon as we get there, they seated us together with all of you, all these significant people from the industry. So you were there. Chef Aaron Bluedorn was there. Evelyn Garcia, Don Burrell was there, and also Matt Pittman from Meat Church and Ben Burtt. So we're all seated at the same table. And I only thing that I remember was it was we were hit hard again with imposter syndrome because everybody was addressing us again as chefs. But y'all were very, very nice, very welcoming, very supportive. Yes, you mentioned that you are a big fan of MasterChef. So at the end of the night, I mean at the end of the rodeo on our way back, I told Joseph that, Joseph, I don't want to be anything but a chef. Cooking and serving Burmese food to the people of Houston. So,
Wow. Okay. No, I didn't know that. And
yes.
then I think the first time I had your food was that you did a dinner
Yes.
downtown at the bar that
Bovine and
formerly was
Barley.
known as Bovine and Barley.
Yes.
Uh,
Yes.
because Joseph was connected to them. I know he'd done some consulting for
Yes. Yes.
them.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So,
He did.
all right. So that was that the first like public dinner, or where was that kind of in the process?
I mean, that wasn't even in public. That was more like our family and friends night with what, like 12 people. I would say, like, since the day that I made the decision that, at the end of the rodeo that I want to be nothing but a chef was there was a lot of testing with water. So I definitely like try to redevelop the recipes, try to put together the menus, conceptualize this whole business model where we can sustainably run tasting menu dinners. So yes, the one that you came to, I believe that was sometime in 2022 July, and yeah, that was our pretty much like kick of our tasting menu series. But in the meantime, I've also started doing pop-up markets with Have a Nice Day, Urban Harvest, and Asia Society.
What has been your experience? Because again, I don't think that most people knew that Burmese cuisine was a distinct culinary tradition. And you're
Right.
presenting,
Right.
lemongrass fish stew and tea leaf salad and duck
Absolutely.
puffs and all this stuff to people. What's the response been like?
Again, like, as much as I am not as proud to say that, I am the product of a reality TV show, MasterChef definitely gave me a huge platform, and then one great thing about our season is because of COVID, we were not able to do these classic challenges like restaurant takeovers or like, you're going out and cooking for 200 firefighters. Like, we were not able to do those challenges. To make up for that, they brought in these legendary chefs, like, so we got to meet and work with, or even being mentored by Emeril Lagasse, Jonathan Waxman, Dominic Crane, who else? Nancy Silverton. So, it's pretty much an endorsement, whatever they say on the show, right? If Nancy and Silverton say that, hey, you make really good pasta, that is a legit endorsement, even if you are a home cook.
Yeah, I mean
So,
it practically goes on your gravestone, right? I mean, it's like
yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
the best thing you'll ever hear about yourself.
Right. So, definitely like MasterChef definitely comes with a huge platform, a lot of endorsements. So definitely, people were interested. People were interested, especially, we were so blessed that Houstonians are always ready to embrace new cuisines, new cultures, new flavors. So yeah, there was already like, yeah, a lot of interest around our pop-ups. So I would say we're so lucky that all of our tasting menu dinners were all sold out events. But it was a chance for me to properly introduce Burmese food through these tasting menu dinners. It was also my creative outlet. So I would do non-traditional, I mean, not non-traditional, I would still do traditional Burmese recipes with my little own twist, using local ingredients. Or, reflecting the prevailing cultures. Like, if you are in Houston, whether you're doing Burmese or Cambodian, you still have to embrace the barbecue culture. You still have to accept that there's a big Vietnamese influence in it. So something like duck puffs, which I would say, like, the Burma on its own is a very diverse cuisine, very diverse culture, being that we're made up of 135 ethnic groups. But so the duck puffs, the origin of it is these goose and onion pies, the British goose and onion pies that the British brought in during their colonialism. And during the rule, they definitely encouraged this influx of Chinese and Indian immigrants. So the Chinese cooks actually take the recipe and started infusing with their flavors, with their East Asian spices and seasonings. So our duck puffs have a lot of like cinnamon, star anise, soy sauce. So it's already an Anglo-Burmese Chinese recipe, which after after picked that recipe up, I was so inspired by these Vietnamese pate show, these pastries, that I'm like, I have to have this duck liver pate in my duck puffs. It is the right home for these duck liver
Right.
pate.
Somewhere between English savory pies and
Yes.
Peking duck and bao buns and
Right.
Vietnamese pate choux.
Yes, Vietnamese French pate choux in
Yeah,
Houston. So I
that's
would say
duck puffs.
those duck puffs, I would say, definitely reflected my journey, and I cannot think of anything more Houston than those duck puffs. So, things like that, like you create that familiarity, you create that the aspect of storytelling into our dinners, and it definitely created a lot of buzz. And thank you. And again, like we were nominated, I think, for the third time from Culture Map, so that definitely gave us a lot more boost as well. So tasting menus, again, were a great way for us to introduce Burmese cuisine, and then storytell and share our recipes and heritage. The biggest challenge I would say is that most of our tasting, I would say 90% of the time, we do it at Tenfold. And if you've been to Tenfold in the Heights, they do not have a kitchen. So we pretty much have to build our own little makeshift kitchen out in the patio, and we use what they call their lab as our plating area. So most of the time it was okay, but I think one, maybe like a couple times before our last tasting menu dinner, there was a stray thunderstorm that pretty much blew away our tents, 50% of our cooking utensils, and all we were ended with is this small little air fryer to reheat the duck puffs.
Recently, you've been popping up at Cucharita,
Yes.
the restaurant in Montrose, which obviously has a more, does have a kitchen.
Yeah.
And so, what's that experience been like? Because, it seems to me
Yes.
that serving in an actual restaurant feels like the next step to opening a restaurant.
Absolutely. So the tasting menus, as much as it has its advantage, it also restricts us in a way that we couldn't accommodate dietary restrictions. I don't have a walk-in, I don't have a pantry that I can just pull something and substitute something, right? So, and most of our customer base are Indians and Pakistanis. So sometimes, if the menu is beef heavy or sometimes it's pork heavy, you are pretty much losing, a big portion of your customer base. So it becomes more and more challenging in a sense. So I would say last September, 2024 September, we finally decided that we have to pause our tasting menus, and we have to start transition to a la carte menus so that, we can give more accessibility to Burmese food. There's better and bigger outreach. So my team loves it, absolutely loves it, that now we have a proper kitchen. We can definitely serve. There's no longer these external challenges cooking outside. So yeah, it's been great. It's been great again, like, yeah, to have a bigger outreach. There's definitely We're giving people more choices. We can definitely serve more traditional Burmese recipes. So instead of, I would say, like lobster with coconut cream sauce, now I can fully push out Oh No Khao Swee, which is our coconut noodle soup, how it would be served on the streets of Yangon, which is my hometown in Burma.
All right, so you've been doing these dinners at Cucharita, these a la carte dinners, kind of an evolution of the pop-up. You were also nominated, in addition to a Culture Map Tastemaker Award, you've also been nominated as a semi-finalist in the James Beard Awards. Did that, like, has your imposter syndrome finally been eliminated, or is it exacerbated that, like,
Oh my gosh.
you're
Oh.
in pretty august company on that
Oh my
list?
gosh. Yes. Oh, we're again, I'm very, very grateful. Still feel very surreal, but as much as I'm like, okay, like really want to go to Chicago. It will be so good to be a finalist, but then I'm like, I don't think I will feel good about myself being in the room with the, the greatest minds and hearts and talents in the country. But no, I think imposter syndrome will stay forever. But again, it's not always a bad thing. It definitely keeps me humble. It definitely, keeps me close to the roots. I always, keep me reminded of where the beginnings were. So it's good. It's good.
All right. So, I mean, we've run long. It's been great, but I don't want to keep you too long. But just, I mean, what's next for you? I mean, because obviously, I think this Kucharita thing has become a popular setting for you, and it does kind of feel
Yeah.
like the next step. I mean, do you want your own restaurant? Do you want to just keep doing pop-ups? Like, what do you, where would you like to be a year or two from now?
Cooking Burmese food is going to be a lifelong passion, and the mission and the goal is to definitely give more accessibility to Burmese food. And I also assume it is my responsibility, being a Houstonian, that I have to make Houston even more vibrant and diverse food city. So again, we know that we are very fully aware that we need a permanent home, I've met and made friends with a lot of people from the industry, a lot of restaurateurs, a lot of chefs, to the point that they're very supportive. They are always in a way that, hey, we're ready to lend your hand whenever you need to, but also they are equally talking me out of opening a brick and mortar, especially in times like this, like spring break, rodeo, March Madness. Everybody is not doing well. They're like, do you really want to own a restaurant?
Derecho, hurricane, election
Right,
anxiety. It's been
right,
a tough
right.
year for people in the restaurant
Absolutely,
business.
absolutely. So, I want to make sure that I'm doing it right in terms of both food and business. As in, if I'm the one putting Burmese food on the map, I want to make sure I'm doing it right and respectable. And also, I still have to, give respect to my MBA background, saying that, I want to make sure it is more diversified than just a physical restaurant or a storefront. We want to make sure we're not putting all the eggs in one basket. So, what we're looking for now is a space, I would say a space of our own where we can push out Burmese food, whether it is in the form of a brunchy tea shop with Burmese tea and pastries like what Emma is doing, or a QSR noodle shop like what we've been doing at Kucharita, or a 7-course tasting menu dinner like what we did at Tenfold. I also want to continue doing these private caterings, corporate caterings, and I also want to make sure that, I am not just giving accessibility to Burmese food here in Houston. So I want to push out things like noodle kits and curry kits that I can pretty much, ship nationwide. So I can assure everybody that there will be a permanent home. There will be a brick and mortar, Burmalicious, with a name of a food blog. So we'll definitely have the name change pretty soon. But I would say the concept or concepts are still in the process of development.
All right. Well, Sue, I'm going to say that does bring me to the end of my questions. Is
Yes.
there anything I haven't asked you about that you would like to discuss?
As much as I want to say that the growth of my business definitely was from these tasting menus and pop-ups at market, pop-ups at festivals, and now like a la carte menus at these permanent places like Kucharita, I really have to dedicate most of my professional and personal growth to the mentors that I've met along the way, mostly through collaborations and forehand dinners. There have been a lot of incredible chefs that I truly admire, including someone like Chef Christina, Chef Myung Istwal, who have opened up their restaurants for me to come and cook with them, learn from them, not just learning the cooking techniques, the new cooking ingredients. I get to learn their cooking cultures, how they're running their restaurant, how they're training their staff from the front row seat. So I'm very extremely grateful for the relationships that I have built with these chefs, everyone that I have met along the way, including you, Eric, in this food industry, and our customers who have been very loyal, very supportive, and have followed us everywhere we have been hopping around town with our pop-ups.
Well, I think that's very generous of you to acknowledge that. And it is one of the things that I think people don't always appreciate about Houston is the extent to which everybody's kind of rooting for their peers. There's not that kind of there's that sense of the rising tide that lifts all boats. There's not, Christine's not looking to backstab you,
Never. Yep.
with the idea that like, oh, well, there's only so much room in the market for Asian women chefs who have been on reality TV shows. It's like, no,
Yes.
the more the merrier. Like come,
Absolutely.
come be part of the party.
Absolutely. Yes. Because I mean, we know in a sense that, even like you are not just representing your own business, you're representing all these POC women as, as together, as a group too. So, yeah, I think again, like, yeah, Houston's been great. I'm very thankful that I don't think I'll be able to do any of this. I think if it's not for Houston.
All right. Well, in the very unlikely event that anyone listening to this isn't already following you on Instagram, how can people stay in touch? How can they find out where when your next
Yes.
Cucharita dinner is, or your next market appearance, or any of that stuff?
Yeah, so all the announcements are made on my Instagram, my personal Instagram, which is Burmalicious underscore by underscore Sue, SUU. And I also post new recipes, our events, all the information on our website, theburmalicious.com.
Sue Kin, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Eric.
You can follow me on Instagram at Eric Sandler. Keep it locked on culturemap.com for all the latest Houston bar and restaurant news. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week.